Radio News Corp reports.
On December 1, 2004, the Center for Constitutional Rights, CCR, asked two federal court judges to forcefully reject the Bush administration's effort to dismiss 12 habeas corpus petitions brought on behalf of individuals detained at Guantanamo Bay.
In an extraordinary move, the government has essentially sought to overturn the decision of the U.S. Supreme Court in the landmark case Rasul v. Bush.
In Rasul, the center successfully argued that detainees being held indefinitely at Guantanamo Bay without charge or trial have the right to have access to U.S. courts to challenge the legality of their detentions.
Oral argument on the government's motion to dismiss 10 of the habeas cases took place before Washington, D.C. Federal District Court Judge Joyce Hans Green. On December 2nd, Federal District Court Judge Leon heard argument in two other cases.
Arguing for the petitioners were CCR's Barbara Olshansky, CCR Cooperating Attorney Joe Margulies of the MacArthur Justice Center at the University of Chicago Law School, Thomas Wilmer of Sherman and Sterling, and David Reams of Cummington and Burling.
The petitioner's memorandum, in opposition to the government's motion to dismiss the instant habeas petitions, dated November 5, 2004, was submitted, among others, by
David Rings of Covington and Burley, Mark Falcock, counsel for Abda et al., Richard Wilson of the International Human Rights Law Clinic at the American University of Washington, counsel for Munir Ahmed, Pamela Rogers-Chapiga of Allen & Overy, LLP, counsel for Suhail Abdul Anman et al., Thomas Wilmer, Neil Koslow, Christine Husky, and Jared Goldstein of Sherman and Sterling, counsel for all Oda et al., Bar Azmi of the Seton Hall Law School Center for Social Justice, counsel for Murat Kurnaz et al., Gidanjali S. Gutierrez of Gibbons, Dell, Deo, Dolan, Griffinger, and Vinecci, counsel for Begg et al., Stephen Oleski of Wilmer Cutler Pickering Hale and Dorr, LLP, counsel for Boumedin et al., George Brent McKimmon of Keller and Heckman, LLP, counsel for Albana et al., Joseph Margulies of Margulies and Richmond, counsel for Habib et al., Stuart Aaron of Dorsey and Whitney, LLP, counsel for Almarbuti et al., Wesley Powell of Clifford Chance, U.S., LLP, counsel for Khalid, Stuart Aaron, Mark Sullivan, Christopher Karaguzov, and Joshua Colangelo Bryan of Dorsey & Whitney, LLP, counsel for Almarbuti et al., Mark A. Goldman of Jenner & Block, LLP, Major Michael Morey, U.S. Marine Corps, of the Office of Military Commissions, Office of the Chief Defense Counsel, Michael Ratner, Barbara Olshansky, Jennifer Green, and Judith Chomsky of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
The following excerpts from the petitioner's memorandum show that the government's argument, if accepted, would leave the right of habeas review recognized by the Supreme Court in Rasul an empty one.
In Rasul v. Bush, the Supreme Court held that the Guantanamo Bay Naval Base is within the territorial jurisdiction of the United States, and that aliens held at the base, no less than American citizens, are entitled to judicial review of their detentions under the federal habeas statute 28 U.S.C. section 2241.
Rejecting the government's assertion of unreviewable power, the court stressed that the judicial obligation to determine the lawfulness of detentions applies in wartime as well as in times of peace.
The government now seeks to dismiss these cases on the ground that, although the Guantanamo detainees may petition the federal courts for a writ of habeas corpus, they have no rights that would entitle them to judicial relief. The government's argument, if accepted, would leave the right of habeas review recognized in Rasul an empty one.
Contrary to the government's contention, the detainees have judicially enforceable rights under the U.S. Constitution, international law, and common law. These substantive rights provide the basis for granting habeas relief here. The detainees are entitled to due process.
Petitioners have alleged that they are innocent civilians who are being detained by the federal government in error and without due process, access to counsel, or charges. Dismissal under these circumstances is inappropriate.
As the Supreme Court stated in reversing the District Court's dismissal of Rasul's petition for lack of jurisdiction, a District Court must consider in the first instance the merits of the detainees' claims.
Most of the petitioners were seized in the final months of 2001 and have been imprisoned at the Guantanamo Bay Naval Base since early 2002. They have been held virtually incommunicado without access to their families, counsel, or the courts.
They allege that they are innocent of any wrongdoing, that they have not participated in terrorism or any hostile acts against the United States, and that they were wrongly taken into custody. While at Guantanamo, petitioners have apparently been subjected to constant and reportedly abusive interrogation.
The government has acknowledged using interrogation techniques specifically designed to break the detainees' will and make them feel helpless and completely dependent on their captors.
Interrogation techniques approved for use at Guantanamo by the most senior Department of Defense lawyer include isolation for up to 30 days, 28-hour interrogations, extreme and prolonged stress positions, sleep deprivation, sensory assaults, removal of clothing, hooding, and the use of dogs to create anxiety just short of terror.
At least 17 interrogation techniques authorized for use at Guantanamo go beyond those permitted by the Army Interrogation Manual.
In approving these interrogation techniques, the government evidently relied on the legal conclusions of the White House Counsel, the Department of Justice, and the Department of Defense.
According to recent reports, the government's treatment of the detainees at Guantanamo has crossed the line into torture. Citing interviews with several people who worked in the prison, military guards, intelligence agents, and others, one report described a regular procedure at Guantanamo as involving
making uncooperative prisoners strip to their underpants, having them sit in a chair while shackled hand and foot to a bolt in the floor, and forcing them to endure strobe lights and screamingly loud rock and rap music played through two close loudspeakers while the air conditioning was turned up to maximum levels. Such sessions could last up to 14 hours with breaks.
It is also becoming apparent that many of those held at Guantanamo have no connection to terrorism. The Financial Times recently quoted Brigadier General Martin Lucenti, acting commander of the military task force that runs the detention center at Guantanamo Bay, as stating,
"Of the 550 detainees that we have, I would say most of them, the majority of them, will either be released or transferred to their own countries. Most of these guys weren't fighting, they were running."
The government has sought to downplay General Lucenti's statement, but his statement is consistent with other recently quoted remarks by an active duty intelligence officer at Guantanamo, who reportedly stated that the United States is holding dozens of prisoners at the U.S. Naval Base at Guantanamo who have no meaningful connection to Al-Qaeda or the Taliban and is denying them access to legal representation. There are a large number of people at Guantanamo who shouldn't be there.
These statements are consistent with statements made by DOD officials since petitioners were first detained at Guantanamo.
Despite the length of their imprisonment and the number and methods of interrogations to which they have been subjected, virtually none of the petitioners in the above-captioned cases has been charged with any crime.
The petitioner's memorandum asserts that the president's exercise of his war powers is subject to judicial review, stating that
judicial review of the executive branch action in wartime is crucial because the war powers does not remove constitutional limitations from safeguarding essential liberties.
The government argues that the president's war powers permit him to detain enemy combatants, to determine the scope of this newly minted category, to devise procedures for determining whether an individual falls within that category, and to apply those procedures free of judicial constraints.
The government's position is inconsistent with the Supreme Court's recognition of the right of the Guantanamo detainees to judicial review of their detentions.
Exercising jurisdiction over a detainee's habeas action would be pointless if a court had no authority to order the end of an unlawful detention. The Supreme Court cannot have intended that result. And the memorandum continues arguing that
contrary to the government's contention, petitioners have stated a claim in which habeas relief can be granted.
The Supreme Court has already determined that the Guantanamo detainees have stated a claim. Pertinent case law, moreover, confirms that the detainees have due process rights under the Constitution that they may vindicate through habeas actions. The detainees also have rights under the Geneva Conventions and other international law that may be vindicated in a habeas action. Finally, the detainees have common law rights that inhere in the habeas statute and do not depend on the cognizability of rights otherwise provided by the Constitution, laws, or treaties of the United States.
The government argues that although the Supreme Court held in Rasool that the federal courts have jurisdiction to consider the detainees' claims, the detainees have no cognizable rights under the Constitution, laws, or treaties of the United States, and the claims must therefore be dismissed.
The Supreme Court, however, stated in Rasool,
petitioners' allegations that, although they have engaged neither in combat nor in acts of terrorism against the United States, they have been held in executive detention for more than 2 years in territory subject to long-term exclusive jurisdiction and control of the United States, without access to counsel, and without being charged with any wrongdoing, unquestionably describe custody in violation of the Constitution or laws or treaties of the United States.
In that sentence, the Supreme Court made clear that the Guantanamo detainees have stated a claim for relief that must be considered on the merits.
The fact that the detainees are imprisoned at Guantanamo does not preclude them from asserting rights that may be vindicated on habeas.
The government contends that because it has chosen to imprison the petitioners at Guantanamo, they have no rights under the Constitution, laws, or treaties of the United States, and therefore cannot pursue habeas or other claims in the U.S. courts. The government argues that constitutional rights may be asserted only by aliens held in territories over which the United States is sovereign.
Our system tolerates the government's exercises of power over individuals because that power is subject to enforceable constitutional limits. Guantanamo Bay is under the exclusive jurisdiction and control of the United States, and military officers and judges at Guantanamo stand ready to execute any command of this court.
The Supreme Court has never suggested that U.S. courts can deny non-resident alien plaintiffs fair trials because of their location outside of the United States. As long as jurisdiction over that defendant has been proper, our courts have undeniably stood open to suits by non-resident alien plaintiffs.
If the Due Process Clause does not apply to the Guantanamo detainees, the government could starve them, beat them, and kill them without any meaningful accountability.
No case by the D.C. Circuit approves the denial of constitutional protections based on a person's lack of substantial connections with the U.S., absent such an opportunity. Such approval would be particularly inappropriate where the government exercises total dominion over a person in what is, in every practical respect, a United States territory.
The Due Process Clause is phrased in universal terms, protecting any person rather than citizens or members of the people, as the Fourth Amendment does.
The clause contains no language suggesting any limitations as to place. Non-resident aliens are unquestionably persons capable of having due process rights. The Supreme Court has long held that aliens outside the United States are entitled to due process when they are sued as civil defendants in United States courts.
In addition, the memorandum states that the Guantanamo detainees have rights under international law that may be vindicated on habeas.
Petitioners challenge their detention under the habeas statute not only because it violates the Constitution, but also because it violates international law, human rights, and humanitarian law against unlawful detention. The prohibition is recognized under both customary international law and treaties ratified by the U.S.
The ratification history establishes that the Senate understood the conventions to be enforceable in domestic courts without implementing legislation. The Foreign Relations Committee stated that the four conventions are almost entirely self-executing.
For 50 years, the executive branch has implemented the Geneva Conventions without questioning the need for additional legislation. Regulations jointly promulgated by the Army, Navy, Air Force, and Marine Corps have consistently treated the conventions as binding.
Finally, the conventions were written first and foremost to protect individuals and not to serve state interests.
Several courts have recognized that the provisions of the conventions relating to individual rights are self-executing and provide a private right of action. As one district court has stated, Geneva III is a self-executing treaty to which the United States is a signatory. It follows from this that the Geneva III provisions in issue here are a part of American law and thus binding in federal courts under the Supremacy Clause.
Although the Fourth Circuit in Hamdi v. Rumsfeld stated the view that the conventions are not self-executing, its decision was vacated.
Because the Geneva Conventions are self-executing, the detainees' rights under the convention are cognizable in habeas action.
Petitioners allege that their detention constitutes prolonged arbitrary detention in violation of customary international law. Petitioners' customary international law claims are cognizable on habeas because customary international law forms part of the laws of the United States.
Treaties are part of the supreme law of the land, U.S. Constitution, Article 6, Section 2, and the rights of an individual to be free from prolonged, arbitrary detention imposed by a governmental authority is one of the most fundamental rights recognized under customary international law. This protection is guaranteed under all international conventions that contain a general enumeration of rights, including the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights and the American Convention on Human Rights.
Thus, as a matter of customary international law, a state violates international law if, as a matter of policy, it practices, encourages, or condones prolonged arbitrary detention.
The Guantanamo detainees have common law rights that inhere in the habeas statute.
To obtain habeas relief, petitioners are not required to establish that their imprisonment violates the Constitution or laws or treaties of the United States. Rather, because the detainees are clearly in custody under or by color of the authority of the United States, petitioners may demand that the government show that it has deprived them of their liberty in accordance with the common law.
The original habeas provision found in Section 2241, C1, extends the habeas writ to any prisoner held in custody under or by color of the authority of the United States.
This provision, enacted in 1789 as Section 14 of the First Judiciary Act, is older than the Bill of Rights. As the Supreme Court emphasized in Rasool, the protection embodied in this provision is not only antecedent to the Bill of Rights, it is antecedent to statute, throwing its deep root into the genius of our common law.
Habeas corpus has always provided a guarantee against arbitrary executive dissension by assuring that the petitioner is afforded, at a bare minimum, notice of the charges against him and the opportunity to prove his innocence before a neutral decision maker. And most importantly, habeas corpus has historically supplied a remedy to detention where there otherwise would have been none.
Regarding the question of the combatant status review tribunals and the relationship with the need for habeas review, this memorandum contends:
the government created the combatant status review tribunals in response to Rasool and to the plurality's ruling in Hamdi that a detainee's status as an enemy combatant must be determined by a neutral decision maker before whom the detainee is afforded a fair opportunity to rebut the government's allegations.
Both on its face and as applied to petitioners, the combatant status review tribunal process does not meet these due process requirements. Even the meager record before the court shows that there are colorable claims that, as they are applied, the CSRTs do not and cannot satisfy due process requirements.
The Supreme Court in Rasool rejected the government's attempt to place its detention of petitioners beyond judicial review on the basis of the deference due to the executive in its conduct of military affairs.
The combatant status review tribunals do not satisfy even minimal standards of due process. They do not ensure a neutral decision maker, they do not provide detainees with counsel, and they do not allow detainees the opportunity effectively to rebut the government's allegations.
Due process requires a neutral and detached judge in the first instance. The actual function of the combatant status review tribunals, however, is not to determine whether a detainee is an enemy combatant, but to formalise the government's prior designations of petitioners as enemy combatants.
The combatant status review tribunal procedures assign to low-ranking military personnel the task of confirming the long-standing public determinations of their superiors. To find that a detainee is not an enemy combatant would require these low-ranking officers to rule that the Secretary Rumsfeld and President Bush are wrong, something known to have happened in only one out of 295 cases that combatant status review tribunals are known to have processed to date.
Counsel for detainees are altogether barred from participating in the combatant status review tribunal process. The combatant status review tribunal procedures instead establish that the military assigns a personal representative to assist the detainees.
These so-called personal representatives are not lawyers, and they are not required to have any relevant training. Moreover, the personal representatives do not establish a confidential relationship with the detainees, and instead may be forced to communicate to other military officials, including the combatant status review tribunals, information they glean from the detainees. The exclusion of detainees' counsel from the combatant status review tribunal process renders the process procedurally deficient.
As designed, the combatant status review tribunals do not provide detainees with a meaningful opportunity to address even those allegations the government deigns to reveal to them.
The combatant status review tribunals may rely on evidence not revealed to a detainee to make its enemy combatant status determination. Petitioners may be detained indefinitely without any opportunity to confront the witnesses and evidence against them, let alone the fair opportunity to rebut the government's factual assertions required by the Hamdi plurality. The combatant status review tribunal procedures provide no meaningful opportunity for detainees to present evidence or to call witnesses. The combatant status review tribunals establish a presumption in favor of detention.
The combatant status review tribunals do not realize the possibility briefly considered by the Hamdi plurality.
The plurality emphasized that due process requires that alleged enemy combatants be given a fair opportunity to rebut the government's factual assertions before a neutral decision maker. For the reasons cited, the combatant status review tribunal procedures do not remotely satisfy the standards articulated in Hamdi.
Despite the court's remark in Hamdi, Article 5 tribunals, as outlined by Army Regulation 1908, cannot provide the process that is due to petitioners, even as modified for the combatant status review tribunals.
The tribunals outlined in Army Regulation 190-8 are designed to determine prisoner of war status, a status universally acknowledged under international law, not to affirm the designation of enemy combatant, a status invented by the government to avoid international law.
The unclassified returns provided by the government and press reports of the combatant status review tribunal proceedings, which counsel for the detainees were themselves barred from observing, reveal that whatever the adequacy of the paper procedures, and they clearly are inadequate, the combatant status review tribunal's process, as applied to these petitioners, have failed to provide due process.
For one thing, the tribunals have shown gross disregard for petitioners' right to present evidence and witnesses.
From the Combatant Status Review Tribunal, records made available to date, it appears that a petitioner's request for testimony from a witness not already present in Guantanamo has been allowed in few, if any, cases. Even requests for testimony from other detainees have been summarily dismissed with little explanation.
For example, the Combatant Status Review Tribunal refused to allow Mustafa Ait Idir to call any witnesses or present any documentary evidence at all, simply because he had initially declined to participate in the proceeding. Unable to present any evidence, Mr. Idir could not offer proof that he was not an enemy combatant.
Nor do the tribunals appear to provide a reasonable opportunity for petitioners to challenge the allegations against them. It is apparent from the unclassified summaries that the only real evidence supporting enemy combatant status, if such evidence exists at all, is classified.
The unclassified evidence apparently relied on by the tribunals frequently consists of newspaper articles purporting to identify individuals and organizations as being tied to terrorists.
Thus, neither petitioners nor their lawyers, who, as already noted, are excluded from the process, can effectively challenge the only evidence, if it exists at all, which would suggest that petitioners are enemy combatants.
While petitioners do not dispute that the process afforded must protect certain information, the only protection offered by the Combatant Status Review Tribunal process is a drastic approach in which neither the petitioner nor his counsel, barred from the process, can challenge the basis for his detention.
The Combatant Status Review Tribunals also rely on detainee statements produced through coercive and abusive interrogations without providing a process where their reliability can be challenged.
The Combatant Status Review Tribunals also do not provide detainees with adequate translation of the proceedings. In one instance, when a detainee was asked if he had gone to Afghanistan for training before the September 11th attacks, the question was translated as asking whether he left Afghanistan after the attacks.
Finally, the Combatant Status Review Tribunals do not afford due process in practice in that they reject as irrelevant evidence that a detainee's connection with the designated enemy was involuntary and insubstantial.
According to an Associated Press report, an Afghan detainee claimed that he was forced to work for the Taliban as a cook, and he sought to call four witnesses to confirm that claim. The presiding Combatant Status Review Tribunal officer denied the request, stating, "Whether or not the detainee was forced to join the Taliban, or in what role they served in the Taliban, is not relevant."
On the other hand, the government argues that the court should adopt the deferential some evidence standard in reviewing the conclusions of the Combatant Status Review Tribunals.
The conclusions of the Combatant Status Review Tribunals are illegitimate because they are derived without safeguards to ensure their correctness. In any event, the executive branch, by creating an administrative mechanism to make factual findings, cannot displace the fact-finding role of the habeas court.
As Justice Frankfurter stated in McGrath, the requirement of due process is not a fair weather or timid assurance. It must be respected in periods of calm and in times of trouble. It protects aliens as well as citizens. If the government is unable or unwilling to demonstrate that a particular detainee is a risk to security and thus should be charged with a particular crime, the public interest lies in protecting his liberty interest.
It is telling that the government freed Hamdi after the Supreme Court held that he was entitled to habeas review of his enemy combatant status assisted by counsel of his choosing. Confronted with the mere possibility of such review, the government released him.
In addition, petitioners assert valid claims under the Alien Tort Statute relating to the conditions of their confinement at Guantanamo Bay. They have been detained for approaching 3 years without any charges of wrongdoing, without meaningful access to counsel, to the courts, or to their families, and in conditions amounting to torture and cruel, inhumane, and degrading treatment.
The government's actions violate specific, universal, and obligatory norms of customary international law prohibiting this treatment. Because the Administrative Procedure Act provides a waiver of sovereign immunity with respect to claims under the Alien Tort Statute, petitioners are entitled to judicial review of their claims.
Rasul holds that this court has federal question jurisdiction under 28 U.S.C. section 1331 to consider petitioners' claims under the Administrative Procedure Act, APA. The Administrative Procedure Act in turn establishes that judicial review is available to any person suffering legal wrong because of agency action. Such legal wrong undoubtedly may include violations of the Alien Tort Statute.
Under the Administrative Procedure Act, petitioners are entitled to judicial review of claims that allege unlawful actions by government officials and seek relief other than monetary damages.
Specifically, petitioners here seek a declaration that the conditions of their confinement violate customary international law and international treaties prohibiting prolonged arbitrary detention, torture, and other cruel, inhumane, or degrading treatment. Petitioners also seek injunctive relief prohibiting these actions. There can be no doubt that the United States Army is an agency within the meaning of Section 701 of the Administrative Procedure Act.
Nor can there be any doubt that petitioners' conditions of confinement in Guantanamo Bay are final agency actions for which there is no appropriate alternative adequate remedy other than judicial review under the Administrative Procedure Act. Their claims are, therefore, subject to review.
The government's assertion that habeas corpus is the exclusive vehicle to litigate petitioners' claims is unconvincing. The analysis under the Administrative Procedure Act differs from that under habeas, and the two remedies are not mutually exclusive. Petitioners' APA claims seek relief relating only to the conditions of their confinement.
It is well established that claims challenging conditions of confinement do not fall within the category of claims for which habeas is the exclusive remedy.
Neither a declaration that petitioners have been subject to torture, cruel, inhumane or degrading treatment, or prolonged arbitrary detention, nor an injunction prohibiting such treatment would operate to test the validity of their capture or the legality of their detention.
The government claims that the challenged actions fit within either the exemption for courts-martial and military commissions, or that for military authority exercised in the field in time of war or in occupied territory. Petitioners have not been charged with any wrongdoing, nor have they been tried by any court-martial or military commission. In fact, the government has expressly declined to apply the Uniform Code of Military Justice to them.
Similarly, the APA's exception for military authority exercised in the field in time of war or in occupied territory does not apply to petitioners' claims under the Alien Tort Statute.
Petitioners do not contest the power of the President as Commander-in-Chief to commit troops to undertake battlefield strategy.
Petitioners are looking to secure conditions of confinement that do not interfere with military functions and are being held on land that is neither occupied territory nor in the field. In this regard, the government blatantly ignores the plain language of the statute.
Guantanamo Bay plainly is not occupied territory, and the conditions under which petitioners are confined there, thousands of miles away from any battlefield and years after their capture, cannot, by any stretch of the imagination, be considered military actions taken in the field or in time of war.
In the present case, there is an entire body of international law governing the rights that are due individuals under detention. This body of law furnishes the court with meaningful standards against which to judge petitioners' claims under the Alien Tort Statute that their prolonged arbitrary detention by the defendants violates international, human rights, and humanitarian law.
National security and foreign policy concerns, the government complains, are matters traditionally left to agency discretion. However, this pronouncement simply does not end the inquiry.
Courts have repeatedly rejected the government's argument that actions taken pursuant to its war powers are per se beyond judicial review, particularly when significant liberty interests are at stake.
The government cites the authorization of the use of military force and the President's powers as Commander-in-Chief as bestowing unfettered discretion on the President to use force against those responsible for the terrorist attacks on September 11th.
The authorization of the use of military force nowhere authorized indefinite imprisonment without charges, however, and there is certainly no indication that the discretion, according to the government, could be stretched to include torture or cruel, inhumane, and degrading treatment of detainees in violation of U.S. obligations under constitutional law, international human rights law, and the laws of war.
It is undoubtedly the province of the judiciary to review the conditions in which petitioners are confined and to ensure that international due process norms are met.
The foreign affairs context of executive action cannot shield unlawful conduct from judicial inquiry.
Petitioners have stated a claim under ATS for prolonged, arbitrary detention, torture and cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment in violation of the law of nations.
The petitioners have made claims only for those violations which previous U.S. courts have recognized as universal, obligatory, and specific or definable. International legal norms prohibiting torture, cruel, inhumane or degrading treatment and prolonged arbitrary detention are well established and have been adjudged specific, universal and obligatory in accordance with the standard approved by the Supreme Court in SOSA.
Petitioners here, together with over 500 other detainees, have been held virtually incommunicado at Guantanamo for nearly 3 years. They have been detained without charge, without being granted meaningful access to their families, counsel or to the courts.
They have been subjected to constant involuntary interrogations involving tactics amounting to torture or other cruel, inhumane, or degrading treatment. There is no doubt that this mistreatment, which was authorized and orchestrated by the government, constitutes a state policy to practice, encourage, or condone prolonged arbitrary detention in violation of the law of nations.
For the reasons discussed above, the government's motion to dismiss the instant habeas petitions, or in the alternative for judgment as a matter of law, should be denied.
further information on civil liberties and anti-terror policies, you may visit Kipo Nisko Specialized webpage on State of Exception.
This information has been provided by the Center for Constitutional Rights.
It has been produced by Radio Nisko with the collaboration of the Shell Center for International Human Rights, a Yale Law School, and edited and post-produced at our studios in Madrid on December 12, 2004.
You've been listening to Radio Nisko.